Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Imagine a place where the plants and animals are different from their relatives anywhere else on Earth, where penguins glide through equatorial waters in search of tropical fish, where pink iguanas skitter across black lava rocks, and dandelions grow as tall as trees. What sounds like the stuff of fiction is actually a real place, the small archipelago of the Galapagos Islands, west of Ecuador in the Pacific Ocean. The region was integral to Charles Darwin as he developed his theory of evolution, and even today it remains a source of great fascination to biologists. Jeff Corwin is host and producer for Animal Planet and narrator of the new documentary Nature's Wonderland, Galapagos 3D. He'll be in Dallas tomorrow night to introduce the film's opening screening at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. It runs through May 15th. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
What makes the conditions on the Galapagos Islands so unusual, even when compared with other isolated island groupings to be found in the Pacific or anywhere else in the world?
Well, a few things. Number one, it's remote. It's a long and very far away place. So if you're going to get there, you have to be one of nature's ultimate pioneering species. The other factor is that it has a diversity of habitat that ranges from rainforest like ecosystems to deserts. And another critical factor is that it is surrounded by incredibly cold and fertile waters, which we often don't think of when we reflect upon the tropics. I mean, it lies right on the equator, but it has waters that match the temperature of the Pacific Northwest in some cases. And you get these incredible upwellings, you know, these great waves of twisting and swirling currents coming from the south and coming from the north, bringing stuff in from Antarctica, bringing other stuff in along the Central and South American coast, and that great swirling and whirling of life just creates a marvelous template, the ultimate petri dish for nature to experiment.
And per square mile, the Galapagos Islands have more unique species than anywhere else on Earth.
Well, it is very diverse when you compare it to a lot of places. And you have to remember that it was fed and injected with life from what is considered the most biologically richest places on our planet, which are rainforests. But if you're going to make it in the Galapagos, you have a very, very long journey ahead of you when you become that first colonistic species, that first plant or creature or insect to set root into this incredible spread of landscape. So if you're going to make it there, you got to be tough, because remember, you're either going to be swimming there, you're going to be floating there, or you're going to be flying there.
Well, we'll talk about how animals arrived in a minute, but tell us first about how the land area that the islands occupy came into existence.
Well, it is volcanic. It sits on this great lava-infused crevasse, hundreds of feet, thousands of feet beneath the surface of the ocean. And as the great convergence of volcanic activity fed up through these volcanoes, it created these peaks and mountains. And over time, the volcanoes became extinct. And when they did, that incredibly rich volcanic soil crumbled away and then served as a substrate, served as the rooting material for plants. And that's kind of how they were formed. And what's amazing is if you go to the Galapagos today, you can see the islands, this stretch of archipelagos, in every stage of life. You see it at the moment of extinction as life has faded away and it is desertified. You see the moment of birth with lava bubbling out and crisping and cooling off in the sea. And you see those middle periods where you've got rainforest and beach, but the erosion process has begun. And I think it's that great dynamic wave of terra firma that allows us to have the great diversity of life that's there.
Okay, so the Galapagos Islands are 600 miles from the nearest continental landmass, and it's understandable how birds and fish might have ended up there. How did other kinds of animals, and plants for that matter, arrive and take up residence?
Well, primarily plants would have found their way either hitching a ride on a host, such as a bird or an insect, but largely they came in by wind. And probably, I guess, the most iconic wind-traveling seed is the dandelion. And we know when these dandelions, after the flowers bloom and the seeds take flight, they're carried on these sort of, you know, gossamer-like wasps of feather-like material that allows them to travel many long distances. So what's interesting is if you go to the Galapagos, what you see is the generations of dandelion-like plants that evolved from that original ancestor. So you see dandelions that are very, very small, and then you see dandelions that are as big as trees that make up a rainforest. So that's how plants would have gotten there. So you see a lot of creatures and you see a lot of plants that are very tough and rugged, like cactus-type plants, what we call the succulents. And then, of course, this amazing diversity of dandelions, because their ancestors could withstand that long journey of floating across the breeze and the wind. When it comes to creatures, again, you're either swimming there or you're floating there. So our diversity of terrestrial creatures is all extended from a few original colonists. So, for example, take the iconic land iguana. This is a creature that probably tumbled its way into the coast from a rainforest river off of Ecuador. It floated for many, many weeks and many, many months until it finally set its claws upon the earth of the Galapagos. And then over hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, it evolved into two very distinct groups. One iguana that takes to the sea like some sort of sea monster, actually swimming beneath the currents to the bottom of the ocean, feeding off of algae, off of seaweed, and one sort of plowing its way like a dinosaur into the interior and taking over that sort of landscape. But they begin by this one original colonist. And maybe that happened many, many times, perhaps over eons, multiple iguanas washed up, but it took the perfect set of conditions for life to find its way there. And we can find that story amongst many of the creatures, such as the birds or even the incredible gigantic Galapagos tortoise. What do they all share in common? They can probably go for long periods of time without water. They can deal with the heat, and they can either swim very well or float. When you look at something like the Galapagos tortoise, it in itself, it's like sort of a mini Humvee, a mini tank filled with all the resources it needs for a very long and arduous journey.
Is there any evidence, Jeff, that evolution is happening faster in the Galapagos than it does maybe in other more densely populated parts of the world?
Well, it probably happens at a more quicker pace because there's really no room for error. And there's not a lot of competition. See, if you go in a tropical rainforest, you will see all sorts of creatures competing for space. But when you go to a place like the Galapagos, you either have what it takes to make it or you become extinct. So what we find is these core groups of creatures, like finches, like spiders, like Galapagos iguanas, like the tortoises, because they showed up there with those tools and skill sets intact to survive, they then had that chance to diversify and radiate out to take advantage of the different resources. So we will see, for example, finches that have sickle-like bills where they take on the role of a hummingbird-like creature, or finches that specializes on and cactuses. In tortoises, you see some that specialize in living in volcanic craters or moving through a very dense rainforest where they have almost like a bulldozer-type shell. Others have shells that are designed to allow their bodies to reach up and get remote little bits and pieces of vegetation to eat. So in a way, I guess you could say that it may feel more rapid or happening faster, but I think it's just by the limitations of what the resources have and the limited core of establishing creatures that created the ecosystem we see today.
And of course, you do need adaptation for all these creatures that were initially evolved to thrive in a very different set of conditions. How, for example, does that swimming iguana that you told us about, how would it manage all that salt water?
Interesting. And of course, that's one of the biggest challenges. We know if you're a sailor and your ship is stoved off the coast of a remote reef, one of the terrifying moments is getting into your lifeboat with a limited source of water, because who knows how long you'll float there before you're rescued. And salt water can be like an injection of euthanasia. It is very, very deadly stuff if you're not equipped with it to deal with it. But what's amazing about the marine iguanas is they actually adapted and evolved to manage that salt. And what they actually do is sneeze it out. Their sinuses and their nostrils will collect the salt that they are getting from the seaweed that they're eating or the water that they're drinking, and actually gather it up and crisp it up and then sort of project it from their nostrils. So if you're hanging out in the Galapagos, which I've had the great fortune to do a number of times, you're often being spackled by very rude sneezing iguanas.
They never say excuse me.
They never say excuse me, but that's okay. I'm used to it. I have a 6-year-old.
There you go. There is a little bit of fresh water on the islands, some of which is provided, interestingly, by those tree-sized dandelions you told us about.
Yeah, it's really quite incredible. They become almost like plant-like sponges. They collect the morning dew and the marine layers that move through the fog or the rare spackles of rain. That water is collected and finds its way sort of matriculating down through the hair-like projections of the dandelion trees and makes its way through the roots. And then often will sort of innervate and snake its way down through the ancient crust of cooled lava into an old lava tube, which is like a lava-created cave. And there are creatures found nowhere else in the world evolved to live in the darkness of these lava tubes, fed by the water that drips down through the roots of these totally uniquely evolved dandelion trees.
And many of those creatures have been in the dark long enough that they don't have eyes anymore.
It is incredible. And we can see this in ecosystems around the world and cave systems around the world. But the Galapagos take it to another level. So we find great diversities and radiations of spiders, some that are just learning to live in the darkness, just accepting their future as blind insects and arachnids. Others have mastered this skill for many, many millennia, maybe millions of years, and have not only lost their eyes completely, but have lost all their pigment, because you know you don't need camouflage if there's nothing that can see you. But to make up for their blindness, their limbs have evolved to actually become like a blind person's touch stick. They actually will touch the cave and the surrounding, both to navigate where they're going in the darkness, as well as to find the food that they're eating.
Jeff Corwin is with us. He's a host and producer for Animal Planet, and he narrates the new documentary Nature's Wonderland, Galapagos 3D. He'll be in Dallas tomorrow night to introduce the film's opening screening at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. That documentary will run at the Perot through May 15th. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
waved albatross, mate for life. But how do you find your partner in such a crowded colony? You dance. The whole performance can last for nearly an hour, and it's repeated several times every day. Sometimes a potential rival steps in to try his luck. The female in the middle dances with both enthusiastic males at the same time. The reward for the victorious is great. An opportunity to mate.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard my guest this hour, Jeff Corwin, who is a host and producer for Animal Planet, narrating the documentary Nature's Wonderland, Galapagos 3D. He'll be in Dallas tomorrow night to introduce the film's opening night screening at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. You can watch it there through May 15th. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. So, Jeff, I have to tell you, anyone who is thinking, should I go see this film, should I not, the Galapagos mating dance alone is worth the price of admission. Can you describe for us what we would have seen if this were television and not radio just now?
Well, it really is an incredible moment of nature, and it's sort of the ultimate gaudy display that a seabird can do. These are, of course, the blue-footed boobies, and they have these incredibly bright, just sky blue feet. And what they will do is do this incredibly elaborate dance, and they'll flop around in these feet. And by doing this dance and this courtship, which then ends with the tapping of bills and the spinning of bodies and touching of feathers, this courtship basically not only attracts a potential mate, but also reinforces the bond, which is incredibly important when you're living on the escarpment of a cliff and you're amongst many thousands of other blue-footed boobies, and you need to fly in, you need to find your mate, and take care of your babies, your hatchlings. But it really is something incredible to behold. And then you have to take that moment, and it's mixed with all these other hundreds of pairs of dancing blue-footed boobies.
The name is, of course, funny to say, but I gained a great deal of respect when I saw them fishing. Describe what that's like.
Well, it's remarkable what they do. These birds are masters of not only flight, but of also sort of, you know, procuring and capturing their prey beneath the rough ocean surf. What they'll do is they'll fly up in the air, they'll spot the surface of the water, they'll be looking for a boil of a bait ball where all these small fish have been gathered up, perhaps being pushed together by an underwater predator, and they fold their wings back, sometimes hundreds of feet up in the air, and they fall and dive breakneck speed into the water, plunging in. They'll actually swim beneath the water, and then capture their food, and then exit the water into the wind again.
How do they avoid brain damage when their heads are hitting the water so hard, sometimes many times in the same day?
Well, it's a great question because, of course, these birds, the price they pay for flight is they have a very fragile and light skeleton. So what this bird has done, it actually has reinforced its vertebra, the bones in its neck and along its back, with spongy-like sacs. So, you know, how I think of it is like, you know, one of the rovers that explored Mars, when it free fell, you know, through the atmosphere and landing on the surface of Mars, it inflated these little balloons that allowed it to sort of bounce its way to safety. Well, that's what this bird does. It has these sacs throughout its shoulder and its vertebra, and that way when it hits that water, perfectly positioned, like a masterful Olympic diver, it's able to sort of absorb the pressure and the impact of hitting the water.
I actually saw a 2D copy, a promotional copy of the film in advance of our discussion, but I would imagine 3D is a really great way to see something like this. How is it captured in the film?
It's amazing how they did this. This film was produced by David Attenborough, who is an icon amongst anyone who loves nature films. So they spent many, many months out in the field with this incredible technology, capturing that moment. So not only do you get to witness and experience the wonders and magic of the Galapagos, but you get to feel it in a very first-person way as it's delivered to you in 3D. And that's what really attracted me to the project. For the last few years, I've had my series on ABC Ocean Mysteries. We've traveled around the world exploring the state and wildlife of our planet's oceans. And for me to be a part of such an incredible project telling the story of the Galapagos, it's made all the more magical with that 3D experience.
What's the advantage, by the way, for a blue-footed booby of having blue feet?
Well, basically, it's what separates one species from the next. It's a sexual characteristic and a species characteristic that basically says, hey, guys, we're down here. We're your kind. This is where you need to be in the colony.
Check out these feet and come have a baby
booby. Yeah, I always
sort
of think about it when you see the male blue-footed booby sort of come in and do his dance, and he's staring at the female with their bright blue feet. I can see her saying to him, like, you know, hey, eyes up here, buddy.
What does New Guinea have to do with the richness of the food supply in the Galapagos?
Well, it's interesting. Again, as we alluded to earlier, the secret to the biological diversity of the Galapagos, a big component, is this great upwelling of nutrients that travels through the water. And Papua New Guinea, even though it's many, many thousands of miles away, it basically is an infusion of all this material that comes through the rainforest, through the river systems, along the coast, and then feeds its way into the open waters of the Pacific. And as it does so, it basically sustains this great diversity of very small little things. Things like zooplankton and larvae of little fish and jellyfish and sponges and coral reefs. And it sustains that and creates this incredible thick soup of life, this ultimate buffet. And as that builds and gets stronger and stronger, it then becomes sort of the initial injection of nutrients for all the other life that lives there, ranging from very small species of fish to the largest of the fish, the whale shark.
Yeah, the whale shark is a pretty remarkable creature. I didn't realize quite how large they are.
They are absolutely gigantic. I swim with, I'm lucky, I get to swim with whale sharks quite regularly as we film them. And in fact, I was just swimming for an episode of Ocean Mysteries. We're at Georgia Aquarium filming with these whale sharks. And it's remarkable how tiny you feel when you're in the water with a creature that could be 60 feet in length, and that's how big they are. They are not only the largest species of shark, they are the largest fish in the planet. But it's amazing. The secret to their success is that they eat the smallest stuff on the planet. And we see that trend, that strategy, not just amongst whale sharks, but amongst whales. The largest of our planet's whales eat the smallest stuff.
And you say they're gentle? I mean, obviously they're not out to eat something as big as a man, but it has to still be pretty intimidating to get up close to one for the first time.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say they're necessarily gentle. I don't think they think in that sort of mindset of a human emotion, but they certainly don't eat large things. In fact, the throat of a whale shark that's weighing many, many tons, and with a mouth as big enough that you could put the front of a Volkswagen in, its throat is the size of a quarter. So that's the biggest thing it can swallow. Now, when you're swimming amongst whale sharks, they're just going from point A to point B, and if you're in the way, you're going to get pummeled, or you may get a kick with the tail. But they're not an aggressive animal. They're not, you know, looking to challenge you or anything like that. They just want to eat and swim.
How does the lava heron find food to eat in the Galapagos?
Well, the lava heron is an incredible bird. Again, an example of how birds have really come into their own in the Galapagos. And the lava heron is the ultimate stealth bomber. It just basically sneaks about perfectly camouflaged to match its surroundings. It moves across the sun-soaked, very hot rocks, and it's constantly searching and looking, and it will freeze up when it senses that something edible is nearby. With lightning speed, it reaches out with its pincer-like bill and grabs onto its prey.
All right, I want to talk a little bit more about these tortoises that you mentioned earlier, that they have sort of exquisitely evolved for the kind of vegetation on each particular island or even each side of the island. There's a difference in the way that their shells accommodate the movement of their necks.
Absolutely. You have sort of a saddle-backed version, and then you have a domed version. And with one of the species, it basically has its whole body designed to get its neck up as tall as possible. So it has access to the nutrient leaves of the plants that it's eating, and it lives in a place where there's a limited amount of edible species of plants. So that's really its strategy for survival. It's a very, very long neck. If I were to sort of compare it to an animal in the African savanna, it is kind of like the giraffe of tortoises. Hmm. Then you have others that deal with incredibly dense woven walls of vegetation that you would need a machete to plow through. Well, this animal does exactly that. It plows through it. It's built to be like an armored tank, and it just pushes whatever it's front of it out of the way in order for it to get about. And what's really amazing is each island or each part of the island has its own specialities and uniquenesses and challenges. And so the tortoises that live there, and even the iguanas that live here, they're different types of terrestrial iguanas, have each evolved their own special way to master that challenge.
Why would there be a pink iguana?
Well, it just is what it is. It evolved to be what it is based on the physical challenges and the ecological challenges it has faced. You either do or you die. Hmm. So if you're going to make it to the next generation and get your genes forward, you've got to have what it takes. And it's likely that that coloration is the product of what it's eating and absorbing into its body, along with camouflage in it to match a specific type of environment. And also with iguanas, we often find what we call secondary sexual characteristics, physical characteristics that allow the individuals to separate each other and to find a potential mate.
And they may have been there a long time, but the pink iguanas are a new discovery for scientists.
And that's really, I think, the beauty of the Galapagos. Even today, in the 21st century, in the ultimate age of technology, you can go to the Galapagos and find something new and something wild that has not been discovered previously. And so here's a species of land iguana that has been under our nose for centuries, and only recently has it been discovered.
What is it like to go visit there? Do you travel by boat? Do you pop in on an aircraft of some kind?
Well, there's different ways to experience the Galapagos. You can fly there on a jet. They have commercial flights that fly there regularly from Ecuador. Or you can take a ship to the Galapagos. And some of the areas that are inhabited with their little villages, there are everything from camping-type scenarios to high-end hotels. For me, the best way to experience the Galapagos is by small boat. And when we go there to film, we'll be heading there probably next year, we go, there's eight of us in our production crew, and we travel by sailboat, and we are sort of self-contained, and to me, that's the best way. If any of your listeners are looking to experience the Galapagos, and for me, again, they're nature's ultimate laboratory of evolution. It's not by accident that our understanding of the natural world through Darwin and other scientists' research has taken place in the Galapagos. But if you're going to experience it like you would any other wild place, I think the more intimate and the more wild and the more sort of boots on the ground way to do it is the best.
What's in the first aid kit on that sailboat?
What's in my first aid kit? Probably tequila is the first thing you'll see.
So you don't worry about like poisonous shooting bugs or...
Probably the most important thing that you could have with you in the Galapagos, especially if you're heading into the interior, if you're going to one of the national park trail systems and you think you're going to be a little remote, sunblock and water. It's very hot there, and it is very, very sunny. And as we've all learned, nothing ruins an adventure more than a really bad sunburn.
Is it still fairly unspoiled when you mention that there are luxury hotels? I start to worry that maybe too much human development is encroaching on what nature has put there.
Well, I think that is a challenge. I think we can love something too much and experience it too much. And that's one of the challenges with ecotourism. What is that fine balance of going to a place, learning about it, taking that experience, applying it to others, maybe, you know, helping to encourage conservation, with at the same time not wearing something out? And that is a challenge that the Galapagos faces, and that's why you can do it different ways. You can go to the Galapagos and kind of feel like you're an amusement park, just moving on a line, and on your left are the boobies, and on your right are the albatrosses. You can also have a very wild experience, and you can really get off the beaten path. For Ecuador, this is one of its most prestigious and important national park systems, and it is their priority, and they do their very, very best to protect it. But I would say the biggest challenge of the Galapagos, and they do their best to manage people coming in and out of it. The biggest challenge with regard to conservation is what's happening around the Galapagos. Unfortunately, many of the surrounding waters aren't protected. So there are issues of wrecks from oil tankers, which happens, which could wipe out species with a blink of an eye, overfishing of sharks and other resources. These are the sort of the modern problems that the Galapagos are facing. And of course, climate change.
Let me jump in. We're going to take a quick break. We'll talk more about that. My guest is Jeff Corwin, who narrates Nature's Wonderland Galapagos 3D, a documentary that he will be in Dallas tomorrow night to introduce a premiere of at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. If you've been to the Galapagos and want to tell a story or you'd like to ask a question, call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th. Now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with conservationist Jeff Corwin. He is host and executive producer of the ABC adventure series Ocean Mysteries with Jeff Corwin. And he narrates a new documentary called Nature's Wonderland Galapagos 3D that will premiere tomorrow night at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. He'll be in Dallas for that premiere, and the film itself runs through May 15th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Jeff, you raised the issue of climate change. Is there evidence, as far as scientists can tell, that climate change has affected the different species in the Galapagos?
Well, there is some anecdotal evidence, and of course, this is a very new frontier, and we are seeing some changes with some of the species that live here and live there. But probably the species that is the most vulnerable of this at the moment are the penguins that live there. There are penguins to the Galapagos that evolved uniquely in the Galapagos. Their ancestors came over from Antarctica, and they've gone from a creature that was designed to live on ice to a creature that's designed to live on the rim of a tropical volcano underwater. So... but they are, of course, remarkable birds. They no longer have the ability to fly in air, but they can fly underwater with their wings and incredible predators when it's come to hunting. But unfortunately, what we're seeing in the areas where penguins live is that as water temperature warms up, the fish that they target goes deeper because the fish likes it colder. So if the penguins swim deeper, they are burning more energy than they should and finding it harder to find their food and also making themselves vulnerable to marine predators.
And of course, they can get by in the somewhat cooler waters of the Galapagos than they might in other parts of equatorial waters, but it's still much warmer there. They're still searching for cool spots just for their own comfort and health.
Yeah, it can be really hot to be a penguin because mm-hmm. they're really warm in the inside and to keep that warmth from escaping because death for a penguin is having damaged their plumage and that water gets in and they're body temperature is pushing 100 degrees, and they get hit by water in the 50s to 60s, it can zap the life right out of them. At the same time, though, they have to manage that body temperature when they're not in the colder water. So they have found ways with how they move their feet and places where they hang out to sort of deal with getting rid of that excess heat. But probably the best way they do that is by being much smaller than their ancient ancestors.
So most people are aware that penguins don't fly, but flightless cormorants were a new thing, at least for me.
Yeah, they're really cool, and they actually seem almost penguin-like. And cormorants, for those who are familiar with them, know that they're pretty good flyers, and we see them a lot. If you don't see them, you certainly can smell a raft of cormorants. If you're hanging out along the Texas coast or where I live in New England, you know those cormorants are there when the breeze blows in and you smell the guano off the rocks or pier where they're hanging out. But these animals arrived to the Galapagos many, many, many thousands of years ago. And because there is not the pressure of predators, and that's something else that's really cool about the Galapagos, not only do other animals have to deal with pressures from the environment and water and resources and other ecosystems, there's also the pressure of predators. And half your time is spent evolving to try to not get eaten. Well, in the Galapagos, you don't have that problem. There are not a lot of terrestrial predators. So this creature doesn't have to worry about anything sneaking up on it and eating it. So it's spent all its energy becoming incredibly large. Its wings have shrunken up to be really not much bigger than sort of the spicy wings you'd eat with blue cheese and celery. I mean, they're tiny little wings. But their feet sort of have become incredible paddles. So when they hit that water, they're propelling themselves with these motorized flipper-like feet. And that, again, is something incredibly special, but just one example of how animals have become totally unique in the Galapagos.
Can you tell us a little bit about your approach when you are out doing all kinds of wildlife scenes and trying to capture things? It's one thing to send a crew out and have them sort of wait all day. When you're out there and you're needing to interact with something, how many takes does it take to get a stand-up where you're on camera and an animal is doing something that you want to show?
Well, a lot of times it's just one. Because chances are that creature's not going to stick around. And for me, the ultimate challenge and the great joy I get is sort of being the fly in the wall to tell the story, to be in a really cool, wild moment. Maybe it's a first time for me, and I get to share it with the audience. The shows we do are unscripted. We are often in the real moment. So, for example, months ago I was in Alaska catching Kodiak bears with a fish and wildlife scientist and putting satellite collars. You don't get a second take when you're putting a satellite collar on a giant Kodiak bear. It's a one-moment thing that's in the real-life experience, and that's how I look at it, to sort of share that moment with the audience. But for me, what I enjoy the most today is really not only telling the stories of animals and wildlife and wild places and hopefully encouraging people to be better stewards, but I also love telling the story of scientists and conservationists who are in the front lines. And for me, that's kind of the new adventure. I've done a lot of this stuff for a long time, but being able to go out on the front lines of conservation with the ultimate scientist who's doing something with sharks or octopuses or with bears or birds, just in Hawaii, working with the very rare monk seal, and to tell how they are fighting to save this species in a way that compels the audience, that for me is the ultimate challenge and the ultimate pleasure when I'm successful.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Amy and Tyler. Hi, Amy.
Hi, I'm very excited to be able to speak with Jeff Corwin. I'm always loved animals and the environment, and I basically wanted to ask, is there any person or persons past or present that has helped influence Jeff to go into the conservation field? And also, could he recommend a book, maybe one of his books or another book you would know of that would help someone like myself, a beginner's guide kind of for helping someone to be an environmental advocate in their local community? Because I would just like to help, learn how to properly speak to people and encourage, more green spaces, because that's kind of my issue is, they put up more shopping centers and can you put up trees?
Sure. Thanks so much for your call, Amy.
Well, yeah, I think there are a number of what I would call heroes for me. And when I was growing up, I was incredibly fascinated by American conservationists, the pioneers of protecting American landscape. So it was people like John Muir and Aldo Leopold or Teddy Roosevelt, the work that they did to help us re-explore how we connect with nature and to protect it for future generations, to look at a wild place and say, yeah, that may be filled with gold and oil and coal, but it's also something that should be witnessed for its natural splendor. So instead of just exploiting it immediately, let's turn it into a national park. The whole global conservation movement and the modern ways to protect species around the world, the concept of creating a national park, the idea that the land and the wildlife that lives here doesn't belong to a nobleman or a king, but it belongs to everyone and needs to be protected for multiple reasons, that comes out of this movement. People like Rachel Carson, this biologist, this woman on the front lines of protecting wildlife, and what she did to wake us up to the impact of pesticides and how it affects entire ecosystems and breaks the chain and link of life. Her work through Silent Spring truly inspired me. People like Darwin, when I was 15 years old, I was reading The Voyage of the Beagle by Darwin, and inspired me to go to these places. Many folks like that. People like Richard Nixon. You look at Richard Nixon, who was a very conservative politician with, an interesting history. Well, guess what? If it wasn't for Richard Nixon, we wouldn't have had the Endangered Species Act. We likely would not have bald eagles or American alligators. So I think what, you can do, I always believe you need to connect to a local resource. And Texas is very, very special in that regard. Texas is home to unique species and unique wild places and unique challenges, especially when it comes to water management and human development. And I think connecting and protecting local resources is maybe it's the Houston toad, which is on the verge of extinction, something like that. And a book that I wrote a few years ago that I'm very proud of is called 100 Heartbeats, where I basically follow the story of animals that were reduced in some cases to just 100 individuals or less. And we tell the story about how these heroes, many of them unknown to most of us, basically in some cases put their very lives in the line or their livelihood to recover these species. So that's I think that book, 100 Heartbeats, can sort of introduce you to the American movement of conservation.
Is it always a little bit scary for people who are passionate about conservation to pull an animal off of the endangered list because efforts have been successful at restoring populations?
I don't think it's scary. I think it's actually the ultimate measure of success to be in that moment. For example, look at the American alligator. This is a creature that in the 1970s was on the brink of extinction. And you can make the argument to say bald eagles pretty easy. It's like the symbol of our nation. I mean, you destroy the symbol of our nation. What does it say about us? But alligators, yeah, maybe at the Dallas Zoo, they look kind of cool. But if you were sort of rednecking it in an inner tube and one bubbled up next to you, you wouldn't be happy because he's probably going to eat you. But yet we recognize the value of this species, its important ecological role as an apex species, and we saved it and recovered it. And in some areas, we're able to actually turn it into a resource that can be used by the local community. So that actually, it's less scary. It's the ultimate success. Unfortunately, it rarely happens. Many of our endangered species today may be showing signs of recovery, but very few of them get to cross that threshold to the point where we say, guess what, they're all good, everything's better, now we can walk away.
Well, you mentioned, you know, alligators, and they're maybe a good example of the opposite of this, but do we have a problem still with getting much more behind animals that we find appealing looking or unthreatening than we do the ones that might make us uncomfortable if they bubble up next to us in an inner tube?
We do. It's very easy to get people to cut checks for tigers and for pandas. It's much more harder to get people to care about and invest in sort of the innocuous things or the scary things or the venomous things. And I call it, and it's been called charismatic species syndrome, the idea we're quick to jump to save something that we like that reminds us of a little kid or a little puppy, but something that is venomous doesn't matter. The truth is nature doesn't look at that. In nature, you know, no species is greater than the other. All life is significant. And, you know, you take a rainforest. If I were to say, what's more important, a jaguar or termites? Most people would say, well, the jaguar. He's the apex predator. He's the king of the rainforest. Well, the truth is the termites are more important because termites, biologically, feed more animals, degrade nutrients locked in trees and get them into soil, and with deforestation actually contribute to climate change. So, yeah, I think it is a problem, but that was one of my missions. The very first series that I started on Animal Planet and Discovery, and today on ABC Ocean Mysteries, I often look at those creatures as a way to wake people up and say, look, they all matter, and they're all incredibly important to keeping our global ecology balanced.
One more thing I want to ask you about that's fascinating in the film. This took me by surprise. I assumed that the Galapagos would be covered with tons of colorful flower species, and it has flowers, but they're all two different colors.
Yeah, it's very limited. It's limited by the ancestors that came over with their color genes and established the flowers and plants that would live there. And, of course, that's because very few of them had what it take to get over there. Either you're going to be something like a coconut that can float in the water and deal with seaweed, and you got your natural flotation, or you're going to be like that dandelion flower that sort of balloons and parachutes its way for many, many hundreds of miles. So they get there, and what's amazing is because they have limited colors, they have colors that work specifically for the pollinating bees and insects that live there, that have evolved just to recognize this color. So they feed off each other. The bee only knows that color, so he only pollinates those plants, and that plant then only produces those colors. And they're sort of locked and intertwined into this evolutionary journey where who knows where it goes.
Jeff Corwin is narrator of the new documentary Nature's Wonderland, Galapagos 3D. He'll be in Dallas tomorrow night to introduce the film's opening at Perot Museum of Nature and Science. It runs through May 15th. Jeff, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Delightful to be
here. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.